It's very important we stop with this artificial juxtaposition of the city versus the countryside, or the city versus nature. We need to think much more in an integrated way.
Nature provides for what we need, period. And I think that if we can embody that as a value system, it completely reshapes even what's like required of an urban planner. It actually simplifies.
Welcome to episode 2 of the Green Cities podcast series, produced by USAID's Green Cities Division. I'm your host, Darren Cambridge. USAID created the Green Cities Division in late 2020, reflecting a recognition that an urban transformation toward green cities is integral to the Sustainable Development Agenda. The Green Cities Division is launching the Green Cities Program, a new global mechanism for missions, regional bureaus, and technical offices to work on urgent environment and human development issues in rapidly growing urban and peri-urban areas. The Green Cities Program will draw on unique external expertise to modernize and scale USAID's urban programs. This three-part podcast series explores the role sustainable and inclusive urbanization can play in addressing multiple USAID priorities, like air quality, water resources, ocean plastics, gender equality, climate change, urban resilience, biodiversity, and economic growth. In this episode, we take a closer look at some specific urbanization approaches and solutions to addressing a number of international development challenges. How is urban planning playing a role in these specific issues? And what are some concrete examples that folks in the international development sector should know about? We are joined in this episode by our guests.
I'm Anne Gary, the Chief Strategy Officer and Lead Scientist at the Natural Capital Project at Stanford, and a Senior Research Associate at the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment.
I'm Rogier van den Berg. I'm the Acting Global Director for World Resources Institute's Ross Center for Sustainable Cities.
I'm Joanna Lavecchio. I'm the Associate Director of the Center for Resilient Cities and Landscapes at Columbia University.
When you start diving into conversations about sustainable and inclusive urban planning, you will inevitably hear the terms ecosystem services and nature-based solutions. These are a key feature of what constitutes a quote-unquote green city. But what do they mean exactly? Joanna and Anne help expand our vocabulary by defining these terms.
Ecosystem services is a way of understanding the benefit of ecology and natural systems to make sure that people can live, work, have opportunities, and sustain life. Nature provides function, whether that's improving air quality, improving water quality, flood mitigation. These are all functions, services that we tend to rely on gray and hard infrastructure to achieve, but are achievable using natural systems. Ecosystem services can be an answer instead of hard infrastructure that has to be maintained over time and just built higher and higher and higher.
So bringing nature into the city in targeted, thoughtful, and informed ways can help address multiple problems at the same time. We call it ecological planning, which is design that is cognizant of both biodiversity and nature, offers really great opportunities for efficient use of resources and for synergies.
What are specific services in cities that natural ecosystems can provide? What are some problems cities face that nature can help mitigate or solve?
So, for example, to manage stormwater, a city could construct drains for urban flood protection, or it could build a park that could store floodwaters when needed, but also at the same time provide recreational opportunities that increase health and well-being, contribute to urban cooling by mitigating heat islands, offer carbon storage and sequestration to mitigate climate change and serve as habitat for biodiversity. So these kinds of nature-based solutions often provide the solution to a problem, but also at the same time, provide multiple different co-benefits or ecosystem services that people in the city and outside of the city can benefit from.
One really interesting thing I looked up earlier is that coral reefs can reduce coastal flooding and erosion by dissipating as much as 97% of incident wave energy. That's almost the whole amount of wave energy that could be attenuated by a coastal storm. That's a very different standard to apply to infrastructure like a flood wall that has to get rebuilt over and over again. So this idea of using ecosystem services as it relates to benefits and costs of projects is really, really important.
So what I'm hearing is that even though cities have been able to showcase the tremendous power humans have to create and build new things, these built forms involve massive amounts of concrete, cement, steel, and other elements of gray infrastructure. As cities continue to grow and expand at such a rapid clip, we are too often looking right past the services, safeguards, and benefits that already exist naturally. We just need to know how to better leverage these benefits. Anne expands on this idea.
We have a love of technology, and I'm not saying that we should go back to being Luddites, but we tend to often in urban systems, engineered or gray solutions tend to be our go-to mechanisms. And we have often forgotten to include nature-based solutions in our portfolios. We tend to take for granted the benefits that nature provides to people. And I think it's important that we pay more attention to them. And there are wise solutions that include diverse portfolios from a full spectrum, from fully engineered and technological solutions to just letting nature do its thing, and lots of hybrids in between.
Joanna sums up this point with a very simple value statement.
Nature provides for what we need, period. And I think that if we can embody that as a value system, it completely reshapes even what's like required of a urban planner or anyone else, right? That it actually simplifies, right? When you take a step back, we don't have to think so hard, right? Like, so this idea of like improving ecosystem services almost assumes that there's something that needs to be improved. It's us that needs to be improved.
And where in the world do we see cities integrating these kinds of ecosystem services and nature-based solutions? Anne takes us to Guangzhou, China.
In Guangzhou, China, we worked with the World Bank to explore the multiple different benefits that are provided by the Haizhou wetland, which is a 11 square kilometer wetland right in the downtown heart of Guangzhou, one of China's mega cities. And the local urban planners were asking, what are the benefits that we get from this wetland, and how do we articulate those benefits so that we can protect the wetland from development? And so we helped them to do just that, to articulate those benefits in both biophysical terms, so degrees of cooling and the metric tons of carbon stored, but then also in monetary terms, so the dollar value of those services provided. And so that's just one example of exploring how, you know, I said earlier that people tend to take for granted the benefits that nature provides to people. And if we can better articulate what those benefits are, then maybe we'll be less likely to take them for granted.
So there are services that protect the infrastructure of a city from things like flooding, extreme heat, etc. But what about services that protect the mental and physical health and well-being of the people who live in the city?
Urban living in general is associated with heightened risk of cardiovascular disease and respiratory diseases and a whole bunch of different kinds of mental disorders like depression and anxiety, stress, loneliness, and schizophrenia. So, of course, a ton of different factors contribute to these risks, but more and more research is demonstrating causal links between experiences of nature and human health. And there's a lot of important science that needs to be done here, connecting access to nature to mental health and also to physical health, often through the pathway of access to nature increasing physical activity. But while we're doing this science, there are also new policy and management approaches that are beginning to connect investments in parks to investments in health. I think people just kind of know intuitively that access to nature is good for people in cities. And I think people are really beginning to make those investments.
In 2019, the PBS NewsHour did a story looking specifically at the connection between investments in parks and green space and investments in health.
As rates of chronic diseases among children have skyrocketed in the past few decades, pediatricians have increasingly looked for solutions beyond the traditional. Sometimes that means prescribing time outdoors.
There's a thing called ParksRx, which is kind of a loose affiliation of physicians and clinics that are paying attention to, you know, they ask at the pediatrician, they ask like, how much water does your kid drink? And do you use a seatbelt? And are there guns in a home? Many physicians are starting to ask, how much time does your child spend outside? And if the answer is below a certain threshold, they prescribe time outside and provide maps to parks and parking passes and try to reduce barriers to getting those families outside.
Here's another excerpt from the PBS NewsHour story and their interview with a primary care doctor, Nusheen Razani.
It seems pretty common sense that getting outdoors would be good for people. But does nature actually help to heal? There's growing scientific evidence it does.
If you take an urban adult into a forest within 15 minutes, you see improvements in cortisol, blood pressure, heart rate. But more convincing to me is the fact that people who live in green areas live longer.
Joanna elaborates on this science and asks us to think about how to measure and value the health benefits of green spaces.
Parks, green and blue spaces, open spaces, these are all the natural assets of a city's health infrastructure. The psychological, spiritual, cultural health benefits of access to nature is very well documented. Our processes always for capturing this value are harder. These are intangible benefits at times, right? The spiritual or cultural value of a place is not something that is often monetizable or put into a benefit cost analysis. That doesn't make it less valuable or of service to people and our ability to live. But this is really important, especially as it relates to environmental justice. Urban planners, right, are in a position to help define this way of thinking about nature as infrastructure, assets, and services to cities, and help to quantify, measure, and include them in the long-term benefits of projects. They can help set the criteria for how cities, planners, designers, infrastructure investors think about the value of nature as one that can have a return that's monetizable, but also critically important to the social life of people.
So, recognizing all the benefits of nature, what can we do to integrate ecosystem services and nature-based solutions into urban projects and design?
I mean, key to it is valuation. If the world is valued along the yardstick of domestic product, GDP, it's not going to work out. So you really need to think differently. I think a lot of relates to looking at risk much more seriously. You know, what we've learned, what all the global science learned, is that investing in resilience comes with much more benefits than costs. So you kind of put the investment ahead of the trauma. So that's very important. As I said, a different mechanism to value the actual benefits of an intervention, I think it's very, very important. We do a lot of work, and there's a large discussion, a global discussion evolving about natural capital. You know, what's the value of nature and how do we measure it in terms of biodiversity, but also in terms of ecosystem services?
I think we have to be building better teams as urban planners or infrastructure investors or whoever's designing projects need to be building better, stronger, more inclusive teams. So ecologists are really good at helping people understand the connectivity between ecology, helping to map the ecologies of place. So thinking about that connectivity means you include ecologists in design decisions. It means you include economists in design decisions. It also means that you include community and local governments, representatives, activists, and organizations in the planning work. These are not dots that typically get connected in the way that we work. And that's a really, really big change and opportunity that I think is upon us now.
One of the other benefits of integrating ecosystem services into urban planning is the role it can play in protecting biodiversity. Now, for a lot of people, when they hear the word biodiversity, they think of remote Amazon jungles, large swaths of untouched land beaming with wild flora and fauna. And yes, many biodiversity hotspots around the world are in those kinds of environments. The International Union for the Conservation of Nature, or IUCN, is the global authority on the status of the natural world and the measures needed to safeguard it. And when it comes to biodiversity conservation, the IUCN is very clear about why cities are important.
300 of the IUCN's global key biodiversity areas are at least 50% urbanized, which is another example of the importance of designing urban areas for long-term biodiversity conservation. Better urban growth planning and management of protected areas near cities and integration of habitat for biodiversity within cities and use of nature-based solutions to urban problems, all those things can help reverse the negative impacts of cities on biodiversity. In some cities, providing habitat is critical to the survival of endangered species. So, three examples from just the Bay Area near Stanford include things like the Presidio manzanita plant, the Mission Blue butterfly, and Ridgway's rails, which is a bird that lives in coastal marshes. Those are just three examples of plants and animals that are endangered and require habitats that are currently in urban systems to survive. So sometimes we have to think about endangered species in cities.
Joanna talks about four big pillars when it comes to conserving biodiversity in urban environments: density, materiality, water infrastructure, and soil health and connectivity.
I think about this in a couple of different ways. I think there are four big sort of pillars of how planning is a tool for biodiversity conservation.
The next station is High Street, Kensington.
One is through density, right? So urban sprawl is one well linked to emissions, accounting for a third of all greenhouse gas emissions. It's also a big driver of habitat loss through the expansion of the urban footprint.
So this means that ensuring that public transportation housing systems are set up to accommodate denser development that's tighter knit and not sprawling, that urban expansion is happening vertically and not horizontally, is a key component to preserving biodiversity. And the spaces in between cities. So thinking about the relationships between cities and what's conserved in between them. Another big factor in my mind is the materiality of cities. So planners can help set the standards for the materiality of urban places. Sustainability of timber, bamboo sources, for example, that can be used as construction materials. Uses of permeable or green surfaces as opposed to carbon-intensive and habitat-destroying materials like asphalt and concrete could also mean designing for habitats. So things like green roofs and green walls of buildings that are designed to attract key species like bees and butterflies, pollinators. There's a really interesting example in Utrecht, the Netherlands, where they are introducing green roofs onto all the bus stops across the city to attract pollinators. It's an example of using that type of a form that can scale. Another thing is thinking about water infrastructure and stormwater systems, waste treatment capacity, and solid waste management. This is critical, especially in coastal or riverine cities. I think another really interesting thing to think about is planning in regard to soil health and connectivity. So when we traditionally think about tree planting, for example, as a planning or design initiative of a city to mitigate for urban heat, tree canopy coverage, green spaces, all these great benefits from planting trees. But in an urban design standpoint or from a planner standpoint, tree pits are these like typically very small concrete boxes, right? They're 3x3. That does not respect the way that a tree grows. It neither allows for the root system of the tree to grow towards the ideal structure for the tree so that it can grow and be a healthy, vibrant, very large canopy tree that solves for all these great things.
What we are seeing is that even though much of the built infrastructure in cities may not grow naturally from the ground or even be native to that area, urban environments are still influenced by the climate and in some cases create their own microclimate. Have you ever been in an urban area, stepped outside of an apartment, office building, or store, and felt the intense presence of heat? And you think to yourself, the weather forecast said it was supposed to get up to 90 degrees today, but as I walk down the street, it feels like it's well over 100. Well, in that situation, it may just be well over 100 degrees, and you may be walking through what's known as an urban heat island. This kind of city-generated heat has an impact not only on biodiversity, but also on the lived experience of people who work, play, and reside in those urban communities.
Urban heat island is a function of the design of cities, full stop. It is a phenomenon that is created by urban design and urban planning. It's defined as the relative difference between the temperature inside of a city as it relates to what's outside of the city limit. And it's the reduced capacity of the city to release heat, particularly overnight. So cities hold on to heat. And this is caused by four big factors that are influenced by planning and design in cities. One is the loss of vegetation and shading. So tree canopy, for example, plants transpire water into the atmosphere, which has a cooling effect. They also provide shade, cooling down the air. The second is the materials that we use to build the city. So asphalt, concrete surfaces, even reflective materials like glass. Those big glass buildings in cities can often radiate or reflect back sunlight with such intensity back down to the ground that it can burn people. It's a really severe impact that's generated by a design decision that didn't think about the sun. The third factor is waste heat. So this is the introduction of heat into the atmosphere from transportation or building systems. And then the fourth is the geometry and the built form of the city. So the ratio, for example, of the street width to the building height impacts not only how the sun hits the ground and the shadows that are cast or not cast, but also how the city acts as a container for heat. If that ratio is too small, it holds on more to heat and it can't escape at night. And this is really a major issue in cities for a number of different reasons. People can't move around when it's too hot. You don't want to stand at the bus stop when it's too hot. So all these investments in sustainable transportation, people may not be able to stand there and wait if it's too hot. People become more socially isolated when it's too hot out, especially elderly people. Disproportionate health impacts. Air quality is directly linked with urban heat. The efficacy of certain drugs is less when there's an extreme heat event. So all these different things impact all facets of society, and it's due to a set of design choices and the built environment. So these are the things that we have to solve for.
Anne points to some of the work she and her colleagues are doing to help one city address this issue.
Urban heat is a massive global issue that sadly is only going to get worse as the climate warms. But happily, investments in urban nature can help mitigate urban heat. So, for example, my collaborators in China used some software that our team created to show that natural infrastructure like trees and parks was reducing daily air temperature in the Chinese city of Shenzhen by 5.4 degrees Fahrenheit during hot summer days, which provides $71,000 per day in benefits to the city. So those are the kinds of metrics that we can create that help to get the attention of urban planning. And of course, urban heat's a relatively local phenomenon. So urban planners have to be careful to invest in urban nature in equitable ways so that they're prioritizing investments, for example, in underserved communities.
Joanna points to some work she has done in Israel.
One example of work that we've done is with the city of Tel Aviv. This is a place in the world that's getting hotter faster than most of the rest of the world. We looked at urban heat at the scale of the city, so the concrete nature of the city and all the social factors that make it harder for people to adapt. Large households with lots of children and families living in them, overcrowding, elderly people, very young people, low-income people. These are the people that it's harder to adapt to under any circumstance, but particularly urban heat. And then we worked with the city to map those and select some public sites in the public realm where you could design some pilot projects that could test adaptation to urban heat, which are now in implementation in the city, are some really interesting examples of what they're doing to retrofit a community center playground and also a commercial corridor in the place with more trees, stormwater management, cooling and shading, and also really interesting opportunities for things like citizen science, air quality monitoring, heat monitoring in places really can serve as a model as how to adapt and bring community into some of those processes too.
One of the ways urban heat islands have an impact on other aspects of an urban ecosystem is how people get around a city and the investments cities are making in public transportation. Joanna alluded to this earlier in the podcast when she talked about not wanting to stand at a bus stop when it's too hot. So in light of all this, where in the world is public transportation and urban mobility being planned effectively?
Well, in many places, a good example is Transmilenio, which is the BRT system in Bogota. It was introduced in 2000. It increased the ridership with, I think, 1.5 million passengers trips daily. So that's a huge opportunity. And bus rapid transport systems are really attractive because you can, as opposed to a metro system, which is more expensive and that requires much more digging and big engineering, BRTs you can kind of bring in to the actual section of the existing road system. So that's a very good example. And I think in the 70s, in Curitiba, in Brazil, it was the mayor, Jaime Lehner, who actually introduced bus rapid transport system with a smart land use planning model around it, which is considered one of the big successes in transit-oriented development in the world. You can't only do the transport system and transit-oriented development. You really look into active mobility.
And what about transportation that doesn't involve motor vehicles, but rather our own 2 feet? How are cities designing for that mode of transportation?
One of the introductions in Curitiba in the 70s was also the pedestrianization of the city center. I mean, now we are more used to it. You see Barcelona introducing these kind of what they call super quadras or super blocks, where large areas of 9 blocks of the city of Barcelona are closed off partially or fully from cars. Those are very successful, but they were considered, especially in Curitiba, they were considered economically very unattractive. So a lot of kind of small and medium enterprises, shop owners said, we don't want that, you know. We have to earn our money, and our money is dependent on our accessibility by car. You know, it proved the opposite. You create walkable city centers, and shop owners, they earn just a lot more because you create an attractive environment, much more traffic of pedestrians, and much more attractive places to stay, not only to kind of walk through, but to stay and experience the city. So really looking at public transport as a backbone for planning, using tools to make sure that you create services and a certain density around this public transportation system, and create that kind of that last mile connectivity.
As people move around cities, they are going to work, school, and oftentimes they are in search of food, whether it be at a restaurant, grocery store, or a local market. Food is one thing all human beings need to survive. How are urban environments affecting food systems? And how are those systems affecting people?
Thinking about like the scale of within the city and outside of and external to a city, right? There are the food systems that are created to make sure that people have access to healthy foods. So where they go to market, where they have food distribution networks, how the jobs are created as it relates to that, where they eat at home, outside of the home, these sorts of things are all planning questions about where these resources and assets need to be in a city. But it also relates to the external forces of how cities generate, grow, and source their food, right? So there's the impacts from in the city and then outside of the city. So as cities grow up or out, these losses of biodiversity, habitat, agricultural land might be very direct. They may also be indirect in the way that the sources of food may not be sustainable in the sense that they cannot sustain the nutritional and food needs of the people inside of the city in the long term.
Roger sees windows of opportunity for building cities with the food system, the supply chain, access, nutrition, not as an afterthought, but as an integral part of the design.
So how can you think about solutions and about the opportunities? I think bringing the supply chain of food much closer to where the customers are, that means that you need to manage sprawling cities and the fact that many cities turn into city regions or have turned into city regions. So that requires you to manage both urban planning, infrastructure investments, and maintain and protect fertile agricultural lands. And so that is all part of a good planning process. So that's one thing. The other thing is that you see a lot of opportunities that are potentially be developed within cities, you know, developing gardening on roofs, around schools, in vacant lots, in parks. And I know the skeptical people would say that's not going to resolve the food crisis, but it's part of resolving it, and it has multiple benefits. I think it's very important that we stop with this artificial juxtaposition of the city versus the countryside, or city versus nature. So we need to think much more in an integrated way, literally green cities, productive cities, and all these things come with benefits that help us to, you know, mitigate heat islands, help us to create much more interesting and attractive cities to live in.
Whether it's biodiversity, urban heat islands, transportation, or food systems, there is one common threat that affects all of these: climate change. One of the biggest threats we face on this planet. And it's already having deleterious effects on communities. Where they live, what they can grow and eat, how they make a living, how they access water. In short, how they survive. If we are now forced to live with these climate-related challenges moving forward, what does a climate-resilient city look like? Roger looks at some of the challenges that cities in Ethiopia are facing, and what is triggering some new ways of thinking about how urban areas access, store, filter, and distribute water.
In Dirdawa, in Ethiopia, it's stunning to see that every year people die from flooding, and at the same time, 40% of the urban population doesn't have access to potable water. So there's something wrong in that system. So looking at climate change, heat, drought, flooding, we need to think through how we can manage the whole system, which we around water, which we call urban water resilience, how we can create that. And that requires us to think in water supply, adaptation measures, but also water resource management. One of the mistakes is that we have looked at this problem as an engineering problem. So we need more concrete, we need more pipes, we need more fixed infrastructure, more desalination facilities. That's not the case. We need to look at the whole water system. And it's quite interesting because I learned that the water sector is not a sector, because the people that bring in the water or the water supply people is a completely different constituency than the water resource management. So where do you get the water, which is often outside in the city region, where you capture it from the river or so, which is again a completely different constituency than the actual people that think about climate resilience and adaptation. So we need to bring them together. And actually what we have been testing over the last 2.5 years in a program in sub-Saharan Africa is work with these different water people, or these different people that manage different components of the water system, to bring them together and to think how we can make sure that we think in systems and that we can come with system solutions. And a lot of these solutions don't require concrete or more engineering. A lot of them require nature-based solutions. Think about, for example, nature-based solution for wastewater treatment. Mangroves are much more effective for coastal defense and stormwater management than many concrete dikes and levees are. So there's a huge set of solutions that can create an ecosystem that can help us to, you know, manage water. Also retention areas that are able to absorb water when it rains, but also retain it for when there's a dry period. If we then look at water supply, you can think about, you know, systems, pipes, engineering. But imagine that you do household level rainwater harvesting. In a way, that sound as a drip in the ocean. Household level rainwater harvesting is like a drip in the ocean. Doesn't make a big difference. That's what we thought with solar too. You know, a few solar panels. But if you're able to do that at scale, imagine 200,000 households in a city of 1 million do household level rainwater harvesting, you start to create a much more sustainable system.
In this episode, we've learned what cities are doing and have done in places like Tel Aviv, Israel, Guangzhou, China, Curitiba, Brazil, Bogota, Colombia, and Barcelona, Spain, So moving forward, what are we learning from these cities and others around the world when it comes to planning cities for a future that will have to contend with the effects of climate change?
Part of what urban planners need to be doing now is thinking about planning in a long term. Unfortunately, our financial systems are not really set up for this. So, for example, way more money is spent on recovering from extreme events than it is for mitigating for their impacts in the first place. This is certainly true in the United States. This is true as it relates to funding for international development projects. This is true for how banks invest in capital projects and things like bonds. We have to be thinking long-term about what the risk is. We have to use that to instruct how we design. Then we also have to think about how that influences public or private money and how those decisions get made around what's valuable and what will be useful in a very long term.
I think it's really important for urban planners to have help recognizing where and when nature provides what benefits to whom. So I think it's important to map, measure, and value the benefits that are provided to people by urban nature so that we can help urban leaders deploy limited resources efficiently and to generate multiple benefits from urban nature. That kind of mapping can also reveal the distribution of those benefits to different populations so that we can inform policies that improve equity.
In episode one of the series, we looked back to the past and explored the reputation cities have developed over the past 25 to 50 years and why urban planning is increasingly becoming a focal point for international development. In this episode, episode two, we explored the present, looking at specific challenges cities are facing and solutions they are advancing. We traveled with Anne, Roger, and Joanna to cities around the world, learning about the evolving relationship between cities, people, and nature. They have been helping cities get the data they need to make informed decisions about what and whether or not to build something. They've been advocating for solutions that protect not just a city's infrastructure, but also the biodiversity of that area. They've also been advancing the science that shows the positive impact access to and integration with the natural world can have on the livelihoods, well-being, and health of people and the planet. In our next and final episode, we look ahead to the future, the next 25 to 50 years. As was quoted earlier in the podcast series, 60% of the urban areas that are expected to be on the planet in 2050 have yet to be built. The demand for urban space is growing. Construction is happening. Landscapes are changing. Ecosystems are being shaped and reshaped. What are the challenges we are going to face moving forward? What are the big ideas that can be adopted and embraced and that will continue to transform the role of cities in international development? This episode has been produced by Christina Wong, Elizabeth Doubt, Nirmal Bhagavati, Shane Hofelt, and myself. Music in this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions. The series is brought to you by USAID's Green Cities Division. You can learn more about green cities at www.urban-links.org.